Okay, Amos chapter 6. Amos is continuing to chastise the children of Israel for their sins. Here in chapter 6, he chastises the wealthy. The wealthy are the focus of the wrath of Yahweh in the words of Amos here. The wealthy and Samaria itself, for the most part. That's all I have to say. That's good enough, I think.
All right. Woe to them that are at ease in Zion, and trust in the mountain of Samaria, which are named chief of the nations, to whom the house of Israel came. Pass ye on to Calneh and see, and from thence go ye to Hamath the great. Then go down to Gath of the Philistines. Be they better than these kingdoms? Or their border greater than your border? Ye that put far away the evil day, and cause the seat of violence to come near, that lie upon beds of ivory, and stretch themselves upon their couches, and eat the lambs out of the flock, and the calves out of the midst of the stall, that chant to the sound of the viol, and invent to themselves instruments of music like David, that drink wine in bowls, and anoint themselves with the chief ointments, but they are not grieved for the affliction of Job. Therefore now shall they go captive with the first that go captive, and of them that stretch themselves shall be removed. Yahweh God has sworn by himself, saith Yahweh the God of hosts, I abhor the excellency of Jacob, and hate his palaces. Therefore will I deliver up the city with all that is therein. And it shall come to pass, if there remain 10 men, that they shall die. And a man's uncle shall take him up, and he that burns him, to bring out the bones out of the house, and shall say unto him that is by the sides of the house, Is there yet any with you? And he shall say, No. Then shall he say, Hold your tongue, for we may not make mention of the name of Yahweh. Yahweh commands, and he will smite the great house with breaches, and the little house with clefts. Shall horses run up upon the rock? Will one plow there with oxen? For you have turned judgment into gall, and the fruit of righteousness into hemlock. You which rejoice in a thing of nothing, which say, Have we not taken to us horns by our own strength? But behold, I will raise up against you a nation, O house of Israel, saith Yahweh the God of hosts, and they shall afflict you from their entering in of Hamath unto the river of the wilderness. End of Amos chapter 6.
That was quick. Okay, Amos chapter 6. Calneh, you know, the Assyrian Empire probably began expanding. It began developing and extending in the 12th century BC, at first in and around Mesopotamia, and then later in Babylonia and northern Syria. I believe the book of Jonah, and this is probably explained in my paper on the timeline to the prophets, I believe the book of Jonah must have been the earliest of the books of the prophets that we have, and was probably in the 9th century BC, and I say that with confidence because Jonah is mentioned as a prophet who made prophecies before the time of Jeroboam II, king of Israel. And I think that's in Kings or Chronicles. I don't know offhand. It's in there. So Jeroboam II ruled Israel for over 40 years, probably from about 790 BC or a little later until about 750 BC or a little later. And we read that, David had taken the coast of Syria in the 10th century or early, late 11th century BC, probably the early 10th century BC, all the way as far as Hamath. And the children of Israel had controlled Syria from the time of Hamath until the expansion of the Assyrian Empire. And it's recorded not in the Bible, but in Assyrian inscriptions that King Ahab, who was before Jeroboam II by several decades, that King Ahab had sent 10,000 troops as his contribution to an army to oppose the expansion of Assyria in northern Syria. And he made a league with the Syrians at Damascus, and they sent troops against Assyria. And evidently those troops lost, and Israel lost its holdings as far as Hamath in Syria. They lost all that. So in Jeroboam II, in his time, we read that he recovered the coast of Syria as far as Hamath for the children of Israel. And that's also where that statement is about the prophet Jonah. I'm trying to look for that real quick. 2 Kings chapter 14, verse 28. Now the rest of the acts of Jeroboam and all that he did and his might, how he warred and how he recovered Damascus and Hamath, which belonged to Judah originally, for Israel, are they not written in the book of the Chronicles of the Kings of Israel? And Jeroboam slept with his fathers. Now a few verses before that, we read, still of Jeroboam too, he restored the coast of Israel from the entering of Hamath under the sea to plain, according to the word of Yahweh God of Israel, which he spoke by the hand of his servant Jonah, the son of Amittai, the prophet who was of Gath-Hepher. Now that particular prophecy is not found in the surviving book of Jonah, which we have. It's not in there. But at least that I ever saw it, I've read it several times. The prophecy is recorded here in 2 Kings chapter 14, long after the fact, after it was fulfilled. And I wouldn't be surprised if all of the prophets didn't prophesy things that didn't end up in their books that survived to us today. I wouldn't be surprised at all. So Jonah must have began prophesying. He must have prophesied before the time of Jeroboam II, and that began in 790 BC, which is why I assigned Jonah a date to the 9th century BC and the expansion of the Assyrian Empire. And I believe when Jonah prophesied, the Assyrian Empire had already expanded into Israel's territory for one circumstantial reason, and that's the fact that Jonah did not want to go to Assyria. He didn't want to go. He was afraid of the Assyrians, evidently. So Yahweh made him go, forced his hand. That being said, Calneh was a city of Babylon. It was one of the cities of Nimrod's empire in Genesis chapter 10. But Hamath must have also been taken and possibly even destroyed by the Assyrians by this time, because this is the prophet telling the people of Samaria that they're no better than the people of these other cities that the Assyrians must have already taken. Then he addresses the wealthy, and he's really putting a lot of blame for the sins throughout Amos. There's a lot of blame for the sins of Israel put on the wealthy. And that's simply because the wealthy lead the nation. And if you're poor, it doesn't really matter to you that you're taken out of your home and replanted somewhere else, because you're going to be in no worse condition and probably maybe even in a better condition than you were when you were poor and in debt to the wealthy. And now your debts are wiped clean. So what does it matter to you if you're transported deep into captivity and forced to live in another land? So the wealthy are going to be punished even further because they lose their wealth. So this whole section of this chapter is basically a warning to the wealthy. verses 9 and 10 are interesting, and I'm going to look at what I said in my commentary back in 2013. The Septuagint reads the beginning of verse 10. What we have here, and a man's uncle shall take him up, and he that burneth him. The Septuagint says, but a remnant shall be left behind, and their relations shall take them, which could be interpreted as a man's uncle, perhaps, and shall strenuously endeavor to carry forth their bones from the house. And one shall say to the heads of the house, is there yet anyone else with thee? And I had written in response to that, a remnant of Israel was left behind in the city by Sargon. And after his inscription describes the number of those carried away captive in reference to Samaria, and that's in 721 BC. And the number of those taken to the Assyrian army, it states that he made the remaining inhabitants assume their social positions and that he put them under tribute. So some of the later Samaritans, as we see in John chapter 4, and the parable of the discourse of Christ with the woman, the Samaritan woman at the well, we see that she claimed to be of Israel, and he never denied her that claim, so it must have been true. So she was probably the descendants of one of these Samaritans that were left behind, that remnant left behind by Sargon II. This is a good verse to speak about cremation, because it's evidently not a sin here. It was done in times of war, at this time anyway, in this instance. I don't see a problem with cremation. That's my own personal opinion, because the Bible, the scripture really doesn't speak on it. The later part of verse 10 indicates that the children of Israel in their distress would not call upon Yahweh their God, but they've been pagans for 200 years. So I think that this is an indication of their fear to call upon Yahweh their God, because they had worshiped golden calves for 200 years. They just don't want to admit that the hand of Yahweh is in their punishment, which is common among people today. It's common among people today.
Yeah, and it shows why they remained pagan even after they were deported.
So again, we turn back to criticizing, to chastising the wealthy in verse 11.
Bill, that's a good point that you made on that. Put it to a modern day perspective, how many people today would be okay with having their debts paid off? When you're talking about the poor, it doesn't matter whether they're poor in this society and then get taken away, swept away in captivity to another society, and their debts are forgiven. How many people today would be just fine with having their debts taken away, but swept away into another captivity, another rule of law, and would give up the current society that we have, which is trash, but still better than it could be, to go along?
Well, that's true. That's absolutely true. However, today, people are in debt for a different reason, right? Most people are in debt today because they're slothful, because they want instant gratification, because they purchase things over their heads, way over their heads, expensive cars that they really can't afford, expensive homes that they have huge mortgages on, that they're just gambling whether or not they can afford those things in the future, that they take out all the student loan debt so that they can get useless degrees that won't right. ever get them jobs, that they could repay that debt. People today make a lot of ridiculous decisions because they want instant gratification, and they think that we're going to always be a wealthy society.
Yeah, no doubt. And that's what coming to mind when you read that was like the student loan forgiveness. You know, how many people that went out there and they spent $150,000, $200,000 on loans, you know, for student to go to college, go to university, and now they want it paid off by the government.
Well, right, but they sold themselves into slavery for a worthless piece of paper, and people have to learn that they have to be responsible for the consequences of their actions.
Absolutely.
James, I believe that very scenario that you're talking about could be a possibility right ahead of us that would take us off of the dollar and put us into cryptocurrency. That's something that I've considered.
In America, though, some states have laws that make it so that you always can pay with cash, so cash is protected.
Well, look, that asteroid that they've found that they're talking about that's on, been on the news here recently that is worth 10,000 quadrillion, they claim, in gold, nickel, and iron. And the NASA wants to, they're planning on sending a crew out there to capture that. Which is just dumb, but I mean, if they could make the American people and they could make the world think that they actually captured it and brought it back, that would be more popular and more valuable than gold. So you could have a fake piece of garbage that you claim is from space and hold that and say, well, we're using this for the gold standard. And this is what all currency is based on now.
I think their current system works better for them. They don't need any standards.
No, they don't need any standard, but they could do a lot with that if they applied themselves correctly. Well, incorrect, but if they were smart about it.
Devin?
Yes.
Well, there's the chapter.
Well, this here, this last verse 14. But behold, I will raise against you a nation, O house of Israel, saith Yahweh the God of hosts, and they shall afflict you from the entering of the Hamath unto the river of the wilderness. So evidently by that time, Assyria had already taken Hamath itself. But the entering into of Hamath appears to me to be the port cities along the coast, and that the children of Israel were still in control of that much territory. And this establishes that in the time of Amos, which is probably shortly after the passing of Jeroboam I, I think. I'll look real quick. And in the days of Jeroboam, the son of Joash, king of Israel, is where Amos started. So, yeah, Jeroboam II might still be king at this time. And he had taken back the coasts of Hamath, so now it's being threatened to lose them again. But this establishes this fact that the children of Israel actually did control those parts of Syria that far north along that entire coast for all of this time since David. Except that short period when they had lost it to the Assyrians. Now they're being threatened that they're going to lose it again.
There's an extra verse in the Septuagint. Is that because they divided it differently, or are there more words? I'm trying to see.
The reference to the wilderness, the river of the wilderness, seems to be a reference to the river of Egypt or Sihor, which was the name for the canal of Egypt and easternmost branch of the Nile. I would have to go get my... Oh, wow, that's horrible. I'm sorry. Esort is very quirky on Linux.
I haven't even got it running on Linux yet.
I'd be still running in wine.
I'm getting there.
Okay, but it's really quirky. It doesn't run more. It doesn't run very well.
Esword 10 apparently works better, but Esword 13 doesn't work on Linux that well, I've heard.
I don't even know what version this is. And it looks like it's really reluctant to start. I had it running on another part of my computer, on another, wow. My computer actually has like four different environments, and each environment has four desktops, right? It's complicated. So I can't get it to run. I could usually get it to run, get programs to run in all the environments I choose. Esword doesn't even have that option when I click on the menu. It's weird. Even BibleWorks has it running in Wine. Now I forgot what the hell I wanted to look up. I'm sorry. I did. My mind got erased. Oh, the Septuagint. Amos, which verse should I look at first, Noble?
Well, I just noticed that in the Septuagint there's 15, and here in the Masoretic there's 14. And I'm just wondering if that's because they divided it differently or because the Septuagint actually had more words.
Yeah, that's I wanted to bring up the Esword because it's the best parallel view of the King James compared to the Septuagint.
I've been looking and I can't spot any.
I mean, I could start looking in my paper books. That no, it seems to me that the Septuagint is actually missing some text. No, it's not missing text. Wow. No, this whole thing is different. Oh, Kalma is Emma Traba. That makes no sense whatsoever. But the Septuagint translators did often try to take place names, even if they didn't understand them, or tribal names, even if they didn't understand them, and translate them into names that were more relevant in the Hellenistic period. And they screwed up a lot, especially with Phoenician and Canaanite. They screwed up a lot.
Sort of like the opposite of the problem we see in the KJV, right? Like in the KJV, we have a lot of transliteration gone wrong. And in the Septuagint, we have a lot of translation gone wrong for those, those place names.
Okay, we're all right through verse 10. I mean, there are quite a few differences. Most of them aren't very significant.
Yeah, I don't know what's going on because I'm doing the parallel and there's 14 verses in both. And I just go back to the Septuagint on its own and there's 15 verses. So I don't know what's going on.
Okay, let me go look in my paper copy of Ralph's Greek Septuagint, which is only Greek. But that's okay. And I got to find Amos and wow, is the order of the prophets different here? From your channel. The minor prophets are actually in front of the major prophets in Ralph's Septuagint, right? Okay. Esau doesn't have this 15th verse in the Septuagint when I do the parallel.
If you just go to Brenton on his own.
It does have it in Brenton when I switch over to Brenton. Yeah. I don't know why that's not in the parallel. That's not a good feature, I guess. It is in Ralph's. I noticed it there first. But yeah, verse 15 is only the end of verse 14 in the King James, in the Masoretic text. So the Septuagint splits verse 14 into verses 14 and 15.
Wow. How did I miss that? I was starting from the beginning and counting looking down. I should have started from the bottom, went up.
I don't know why that's not reflected when I go into eSword and put it in parallel mode, which is supposed to compare two versions, right? And it neglects the extra verse in Brenton Septuagint. So it's like it's not there. But when I look at the single view of just the Septuagint, it is there. So that's a weakness in the eSword software, if I ever saw one. I'll have to remember that.
So I would say, like, this chapter is a pretty good juxtaposition to show, especially in verse 10, especially how you should not respond when you undergo a crisis. And then Lamentations is sort of like the guide on how to respond. Because Jeremiah in Lamentations, he acknowledges to Yahweh, like, we deserve this. This is your will. Have mercy on us. And then here in Amos, we see people being portrayed as doing the exact opposite of that.
Right. When you suffer some calamity, you should seek out in your heart, like, and even if you don't find any sin per se, you should still beg for repentance, pray for repentance, and pray for mercy from judgment. Not harden your heart and be arrogant enough to think, like it's reflected in the revelation of the whore, right? I'm not a virgin, and I've done no harm or no wrong or whatever. I'm paraphrasing. I sit a virgin, and I'm not a widow. I'm not a widow. That's what she says.
Then there's the other one. The whore wipes her mouth and says, "I have committed no sin."
Right. That's in Proverbs. That's a very good one.
Yeah, and in Isaiah 45, the whore says, "I am, and there is none else," which shows her humanism.
And whatever I just did to Bible Works, Joe, I got an exception, and it crashed on me, so I got to restart it.
In Linux, man.
Wine, the Bible Works, Wine has taken some turns with some updates, the last three or four updates of Wine. And I'm actually using the oldest one that I could get from the repository. I'm using one from three or four versions ago. And before that, the last three or four updates, BibleWorks got worse and worse and worse to the point where I might have to install VirtualBox instead of Wine and install a copy of Windows 10 inside a VirtualBox so I could use BibleWorks without it crashing constantly.
Well, I was thinking of doing that, Bill, but just to let you know quickly, there's a new program called Bottles, and it helps you. You can set each program's Wine, different version of Wine and stuff like that inside Bottles per a program, if you know what I mean. It's called Bottles. Yeah, Bottles. For Linux, and you just, it's pretty easy to install. You have to use a Flatpak.
I use Flatpak for a couple of programs. I use Snap, I use Flatpak, I use them all, man. I use Docker. Not on this machine though. The problem with that might be that in order to use an older version of Wine, you have to be able to install that older version of Wine. I don't know. I'd have to look. But thanks for telling me about that, because I'll see if it's in a repository. In fact, I'm going to check right now.
I don't know if it is, because I couldn't get a snap of it. I had to actually, use the console and get it from FlatHub.
Yeah, I'll have to see if. It's not a repository. It is on FlatHub. Running Windows in a bottle. This must be an alternative to VirtualBox.
It's not a virtual machine. It's just, it's like a Wine GUI that allows you to some extra to configure Wine and add some command launch commands and stuff like that.
Okay, it might be worth trying. If I could install it on Manjaro. If it's on FlatHub, I should be able to. Thank you.
Ready for seven?
Yes.
I'm going to read half of it because there's like two major themes here in the chapter, and we'll divide it.
Wonderful.
Thus has Yahweh God showed unto me. And behold, he formed grasshoppers in the beginning of the shooting up of the latter growth. And lo, it was the latter growth after the king's mowings. And it came to pass that when they had made an end of eating the grass of the land, then I said, O Yahweh God, forgive, I beseech thee. By whom shall Jacob arise? For he is small. Yahweh repented for this. It shall not be, saith Yahweh. Thus has the Lord God showed unto me. And behold, the Lord God called to contend by fire, and did devour the great deep, and did eat up a part. Then said I, O Lord God, cease, I beseech thee. By whom shall Jacob arise? For he is small. Yahweh repented for this. This also shall not be, saith the Lord God. Thus he showed me, and behold, the Lord stood upon a wall made by a plumb line, with a plumb line in his hand. Yahweh said unto me, Amos, what see you? And I said, a plumb line. Then said the Lord, behold, I will set a plumb line in the midst of my people Israel. I will not again pass by them any more. And the high places of Isaac shall be desolate, and the sanctuaries of Israel shall be laid waste. And I will rise against the house of Jeroboam with the sword. End of verse 9.
Well, that plumb line looks like some harsh judgment, doesn't it? It divides the people that are going to be cut off, evidently, from the people that are going to be preserved.
User
determines who would survive and go into captivity and who would remain behind, either dead or alive.
Also, at verse 4, it says, behold, the Lord God called to contend by fire, and it devoured the great deep. So if it's devouring the great deep, does that mean, like, the waters of the ocean represent people or something?
Then said I, O Yahweh God, cease, I beseech thee. By whom shall Jacob arise? For he is small. So yes, that represents the sea of the people of Israel in this context. Because Amos sees this and he fears that Jacob won't arise because he is made small, that the children of Israel wouldn't survive, is his fear expressed in verse 5. So Yahweh repented for this. This also shall not be, saith Yahweh God. Now that repentance is in the mind of the prophet, not in the mind of God, because Yahweh is telling the prophet that no, they won't be totally eliminated. That's how I read that.
Though I think I remember reading in your commentary on Amos that this is a dual prophecy for the end times, because it
yes,
says
I believe so.
It
I
was
believe
the latter growth. Yeah, the ladder growth, right?
Yes, and that is the latter rain of Micah, or Joel, I'm sorry, of Joel. And I also compared this to the parallel prophecy in Joel chapter 1. Remember, Joel was also a prophecy, a prophet that was contemporary, roughly, with Amos, Isaiah, and Hosea. And he was actually a little bit later. I'm sorry, I'm thinking about Micah. Joel was a little later. And Joel had given this prophecy about the pommel worm and the locust and the canker worm and the caterpillar. And that was in reference to what had happened to Israel and Judah. That which the pommel worm had left, the locust ate, and what the locust left, the canker worm ate. That is a prophecy of the successive armies that had already taken much of Israel and Judah into captivity or killed them. And that's also a dual prophecy, but that's not realized until you get to the portion of Joel in chapter 2 where it speaks of the early rain and the later rain and that great day of the wrath of God to be in the future.
So this is a time when the harvest is quite near, because that latter growth is the harvest, right?
It seems to be the latter growth, the caterpillars appearing in latter growth, kind of seems to me to indicate that the caterpillars of this time in Palestine didn't tend to appear until late summer, just before the harvest. That's the latter growth. I mean, the early growth would be the Feast of First Fruits. And then you would have a latter growth. That's how I look at that. The latter growth being the end of the growing season, when you expect the bounty of your crops, the majority of your crops. And then the caterpillars show up and eat it all. Ain't that a bitch?
And it's interesting, mowings here, right? Like the king's mowings. I'm going to guess that king is Christ, Yahweh God. And mowings, I'm looking at the Hebrew, and it seems to be an accurate translation, sort of like cutting grass. So it's not like he's plucking the grass up per se, he's just cutting it in half, like chastisement. He's not uprooting it, he's just cutting it in half. He's not killing it to the root. Microphone muted.
Wouldn't it be the king though of Assyria who's it's his mowings, because he's taking away the people captive?
I'm thinking of the far vision, because it's Christ, like God, who sends like the canker worm and everything for our punishment.
That gez, that shearing or mowing, I would liken that to the harvest. That the grain has to be cut down before it's gathered up into baskets and brought to the threshing floor.
Okay, right. Wheat and tares.
They don't pick the seed in the field.
User was moved to your channel.
We have somebody new here.
The spring crop was after the king's mowing. So the locusts come after the king's mowing. So isn't this like the first captivity, you know, the king's mowing? Whose mowing is that? Isn't it the people being taken away captive, and now these locusts come in and devour the land?
Well, it's definitely the latter growth, so it's after the Feast of First Fruits. Maybe in... Yeah, I hate to conjecture, but maybe in pagan Israel, the king got the first fruits instead of Yahweh in the temple. What if that's the case? Why would Israel send their first fruits to the temple if the king had forced them all to follow along with the golden calf paganism. It's definitely not the king doing mowing. It's mowings which are done for the king.
By a vast swarm of locusts.
No, the grasshoppers didn't come to the ladder growth.
After.
The beginning of the shooting up of the ladder growth. And lo, it was the ladder growth after the king's mowings.
So the king takes his portion, then these locusts come into the land and devour the rest.
That's what I'm looking at, yes.
But who's this king built? Which king is this? Is it the king of Israel or is it the king of their enemies?
I think it's Jeroboam.
Oh, okay.
Yeah, especially since Jeroboam's mentioned at the end of this discourse.
Amos is talking like this, that this feature of this king's mowings is a regular thing, that the reader should understand what he means by it. So I'm thinking that maybe in pagan Israel, the king got the first fruits. That's what I'm thinking.
Yeah, and that would have been an injustice, like he's robbing them.
Yes.
And now after the king's robbed him, he's inviting all these swarms of locusts to come in. So that's the enemy, I guess. I guess that's how we're reading it.
You know, in Micah, when it says arise and thresh in that verse at the end, it also says, and consecrate their gain unto Yahweh of the whole earth. It sort of feels like the first fruit offering of that harvest, you know?
Absolutely. And that's a good parallelism. That's a good example to explain this.
When I'm looking at this chapter in the far vision, what I'm seeing here is formed grasshoppers in the beginning of the shooting up of the latter growth. So like in the time of the end, he sows the seed of men with the seed of beasts, and they're consuming in the land of Israel. And then he contends by fire, sort of how he does in Revelation chapter 20. And then Amos sees Yahweh himself on the wall. And that's sort of like the second coming to me.
Yeah, you know, that could be parallel. I would agree with that could be parallel to the Revelation.
Yeah, because it's following the same order of events, right? At least to me, that's how I'm seeing it right now. I can continue if you guys want.
Yes.
Verse 10. Then Amaziah, the priest of Bethel, sent to Jeroboam, king of Israel, saying, Amos has conspired against you in the midst of the house of Israel. The land is not able all his words. For thus Amos says, Jeroboam shall die by the sword, and Israel shall surely be led away captive out of their own land. Also, Amaziah said unto Amos, O you seer, go, flee you away into the land of Judah, and there eat bread, and prophesy there. But prophesy not again any more at Bethel, his chapel, and it is the king's court. Then answered Amos and said to Amaziah, I was no prophet, neither was I a prophet's son, but I was a herdsman and a gatherer of sycamore fruit. And Yahweh took me as I followed the flock, and Yahweh said unto me, Go, prophesy unto my people Israel. Now therefore hear you the word of Yahweh. You say, Prophesy not against Israel. Drop not your word against the house of Isaac. Therefore thus says Yahweh, Life shall be a harlot in the city, and your sons and your daughters shall fall by the sword. And your land shall be divided by line, die in a polluted land, and Israel shall surely go into captivity forth of his land. End of Amos chapter 7.
Very often women are forced into prostitution or prostituting themselves in one form or another because their husbands are suddenly taken from them. They're bereaved of their children and they have no other source of sustenance, of income.
This is like literally the reverse of the guard in the jail in Philippi, I believe it was, because he saved his household through his own righteousness, because ostensibly men follow the leader of the house and everyone in the household. And then here, in an opposite, Amaziah dooms his wife through his unrighteousness. So we sort of can see here just how the leader of a household can determine the fate of the people who live with him based on how he lives his life. My interpretation.
No, that's true. And he's going like to die in a polluted.
It's like his wife is being punished for his sin.
Well, that's going to be his punishment, and the people that he supposedly loves, his wife and his children, are going to suffer for it, yes, and that's part of his punishment. He's going to have to face them in the afterlife. He's going to have to face them, and they're going to know what he did and on account of why they were punished. For his error.
I mean, the husband is always responsible for the wife. Like, God died for his wife. But the wife must have a part in the husband's sins too. I'm not referring to God here, but wife must have a reward and an inheritance with the husband. So if her husband is a sinner, wouldn't she have a part in that? Like, that's her lot too.
You know, this Amaziah must have been doing pretty well for himself to be a priest and a supposed prophet in the king's chapel. He must have had an awfully comfortable life that his wife must have agreed with that life and benefited from that life.
Well, do That's women true. Have their own lot in life and their own rights and all this sort of stuff? Isn't their lot in life Microphone and their share activated. In life? Like from their husband?
Yes, but a righteous wife as Paul, I think it was, said a righteous wife can set an example and persuade an evil husband into a good conduct. So she evidently wasn't a righteous wife.
I suppose this chapter makes it clear that Amos wasn't a Levite.
Right, no, he wasn't. Gath Hefer. Damn it. I'm trying to think of what tribe that belonged to, but I can't remember.
What? I don't have all my Bible tools, but what's that word for polluted there? Like, you shall die in a polluted land.
You know, Gath Hefer was somewhere in Galilee, I think.
It's Tom Angel. Strong's says foul in a religious sense, defiled, infamous, polluted, unclean.
Unclean.
Yeah, Tame is the common word for that. Something unclean or impure.
It just makes me think of the failings of the priest. I don't know where the verse is, but they failed to distinguish between the clean and the unclean and the profane and the holy. And now they're dying. I know this is a different section of the Bible, but you'll die in a polluted land if you fail to do that. It just seems just to me. Like, why is he dying in a polluted land? It must be just.
Yeah, well, the punishment fits the sin. I'm trying to remember whether or not we saw the fulfillment of this, but probably not. Amos 8 in the basket of summer fruit.
Yeah, that's a good one.
Let me just say that Bethel was significant here because that was the seat of the religious seat of Israel, the 10 tribes of Israel, in whose capital was in Samaria. Bethel was kind of close by in the ancient land of Ephraim. And there were two places where Jeroboam won. Not this Jeroboam II, but Jeroboam I, who was the first king of Israel in a divided kingdom, where he instituted the worship of the golden calves, were Bethel and Dan. So Bethel is in the land of Ephraim, in the same land as Samaria. And that was his religious capital, more or less, where Dan seemed to have been secondary.
And despite being a pagan priest, he still has a name with Yahweh in it, Amaziah.
Yeah, that's pretty incredible.
Yeah, it's like really ironic.
Yes, it is ironic. Yahweh is mighty, is what it means.
I also find it sort of sick in verse 16 where he says, drop not your word against the house of Isaac, like as a defense, because Samaria at that time was not at all doing something which Isaac would be proud of or approve of, and he's trying to use that as a defense, as if they stand for the patriarchs anymore.
Right, but since Isaac means he laughs, then Amaziah is just basically making a joke.
And he don't right.
He don't even know it.
I didn't think of that. That's funny.
Isaac's just laughing at him.
Chapter 8?
Yes, sir.
Thus has Yahweh God showed unto me, and behold, a basket of summer fruit. And he said, Amos, what see you? And I said, a basket of summer fruit. Then said Yahweh unto me, the end is come upon my people of Israel. I will not again pass by them any more. And the songs of the temple shall be howlings in that day, saith Yahweh God. There shall be many dead bodies in every place. they shall cast them forth with silence. Hear this, O you that swallow up the needy, even to make the poor of the land to fail, saying, when will the new moon be gone, that we may sell corn, and the Sabbath, that we may set forth wheat, making the ephah small and the shekel great, and falsifying the balances by deceit? We may buy the poor for silver, and the needy for a pair of shoes, yea, and sell the refuse of the wheat. Yahweh has sworn by the excellency of Jacob, surely I will never forget any of their works. Shall not the land tremble for this, and everyone mourn that dwell therein? And they shall rise up holy as a flood, cast out and drowned, as by the flood of Egypt. And it shall come to pass in that day, saith Yahweh God, that I will cause the sun to go down at noon, and I will darken the earth in the clear day. And I will turn your feasts into mourning, and all your songs into lamentation. And I will bring up sackcloth upon all loins, and baldness upon every head, and I will make it as the mourning of an only son, and the end thereof as a bitter day. Behold, the days come, saith Yahweh God, that I will send a famine in the land, not a famine of bread, nor a thirst for water, but of hearing the words of Yahweh. And they shall wander from sea to sea, and from the north even to the east. They shall run to and fro to seek the word of Yahweh, and shall not find it. In that day, virgins and young men faint for thirst. They that swear by the sin of Samaria, and say, your God, O Dan, lives, and the manor of Beersheba lives, even they shall fall and never rise up again. End of chapter 8.
Beersheba was one of the southernmost cities in Israel. It may have been the southernmost city. I thought it was in Judah, though. I might be mistaken.
What's the phrase, from where to Beersheba? There's a phrase.
It would be from Dan to Beersheba, wouldn't it be?
Oh, I guess so.
Dan being outside of the original territory of Israel, that there was an account, I think, in the book of Judges, where some of the tribe of Dan had gone north and taken a city for themselves and named it Dan. I think the originally it was named Laish, if I'm not mistaken.
Yes, you're right. I remember that part. They felt like their original territory wasn't big enough for them.
It was right in Simeon and Judah.
Well, Beersheba, Simeon never had territory of his own.
Of the tribe
Jacob
of Simeon.
Told him he was going to be scattered in Israel, but his territory was really towns within Judah, Beersheba.
Right, I'm sorry. It's the tribe of Simeon.
Okay, Judah. So it was one of the towns of Simeon within Judah. That's fine. Thank you. Simeon had just had a bunch of towns in southern Judah, as far as I remember. But no specific territory. Because Simeon, like Levi, was to be scattered in Israel, as Jacob had prophesied in Genesis, I think it's chapter 49, chapter 50, something like that. So Levi was scattered in Israel, but he was exalted and given this priesthood, where Simeon was scattered in Israel, but mostly contained in Judah and not rewarded anything. So Simeon must have had a
user entered your channel
role to play in unrighteousness at Shechem. And maybe Levi really didn't, or there was some other extenuating factor that we're not aware of, because Jacob had chastised them both, but Levi was rewarded by Yahweh. Jacob left neither of them in a share of the inheritance, basically. Well, this basket of summer fruit, I had in my commentary, explain it. There's a word play on Hebrew here. In Hebrew, not in English. I saw the forum posts, the chat posts. The word fruit, summer fruit, is kayits, Q-A-Y-I-T-S. And the word for end is kets, which is really our English word cut. Kets is end. It's what's the piece that's cut off. And fruit is kayits. And I really believe those two words are related, because the fruit is what's cut off of the plant, right? And saved, more or less. That's what's taken to the threshing floor. So I really think those two words are related in Hebrew, even if Strong's doesn't relate them. I don't remember if he does or not. I didn't make a note of it. But that seems to be also a wordplay between summer fruit and the end upon the people of Israel. That Yahweh was taking his fruit, that Ketz word. Here, I mean, in the last chapter, which I think had more to do with the wealthy, the people weren't or refused to or were afraid to call on the name of Yahweh, or just didn't want to acknowledge him, is what it really seemed to be. But now when the famine comes upon them, they're portrayed as seeking the word of Yahweh, and they wouldn't find it. And that's a punishment too, because they didn't seek it when times were good. So they don't deserve it. They just swear by the sin of Samaria and say, "Thy God, O Dan, liveth, the manor of Beersheba liveth." That's a condemnation, that's a guarantee that the idolaters in Israel, because I'm sure it wasn't the entire nation that was going along with Jeroboam 1's decrees, but the idolaters in Israel would be destroyed, according to this. So any child of Israel that is alive today should be grateful that his ancestors weren't among these idolaters in Israel.
Yeah, what you say about the summer fruit, Bill, that sort of reminds me of branches that produce no fruit are cut off and thrown in the fire. Well, yes. That would be temporal salvation. They no longer have a name in Israel, wouldn't it?
Well, right. They would no longer have a name in Israel. They wouldn't have any descendants.
Like, I always connect it to, like, broken branches being, you know, that they've race mixed and now they have no longer have a name in Israel. But temporal salvation doesn't always mean your race mixed out of existence. It could mean, like, what's happening here, that these idolaters are just being destroyed and no longer have a name in Israel.
Right. Right. It's not only race mixing that destroys a name. Simply the fact that there are no living descendants in a particular male line.
You know, verse 5 and 6 remind me of when they got rid of the Sunday laws. In the last, 45, 50 years?
We call them blue laws in the States. I don't know about Canada.
Yeah, it took around, where I'm from, Canada, until around the mid-80s, late 80s, and then they started, everything was open on Sunday. And then,
yep, same here.
Yeah, it was in the mid-70s, probably in New Jersey. But there are still some counties in New Jersey that do have some blue laws in place, maybe not all of them. But when I was a kid, all the stores that sold clothing or electronics or anything that wasn't a necessity were forced to close on Sundays. You could only go to the supermarket for food. Some department stores had food sections, so we'd go in the department store, and the toys and the entertainments and the clothing aisles were roped off that you couldn't go down them, but you could go to the food section. or the toiletry section and buy toilet paper.
That is such bull. You know, if people fail to prepare for the Sabbath, you know, they're not going to die if they don't eat for a day. So they should just be like.
Yeah, well, a couple of times and you'd learn to buy enough food for Sunday, right?
Yep.
You know, I went to South Carolina in 1995 when I was 20. Visit a friend who went to school there. And three of us went. And we would go out late drinking on a Saturday or any time we drink because we'd save money, right? We'd drink at the hotel and then go out around 11 p.m. And then we found out that they close at midnight because Sunday is the next day. And we were really angry.
Now, in New Jersey, the bars stayed open until 3 a.m. Sunday morning. But on Sunday, they would not open until noon in New Jersey so that they didn't compete with the churches.
Oh, yeah. So you're walking in the church half drunk.
Yeah. So the bars would not open until noon on a Sunday. And on a Sunday, you could not buy any packaged goods, meaning you couldn't take any beer out of the bar and take it home. The liquor stores were closed and you couldn't buy packaged goods on a Sunday. When I was a kid, the gas stations didn't sell beer, right? The gas stations fixed cars, actually. They didn't have markets.
In verse 11,
a bar or a liquor store.
In verse 11, concerning the famine of the words of Yahweh, you could say that that famine lasted until Christ and the ministry of reconciliation. And then you can look at it another way and say that it lasted until the opening of the little book. And then even all the still more, you could look at it another way and say that the famine is still persisting even until now, because the word of Yahweh is not actually taught. And who is blind but Israel, my servant, right? So like, depending on how you look at it, that famine could still be going on right now.
Ongoing process.
It is an ongoing process, I believe. Even the opening of the little book is an ongoing process. I mean, yeah, sure, it was open during a Reformation, but is it really still open to most people? No.
True.
It's an ongoing process. I was arguing with some clown on Gab today, and man, was he obstinate. Any excuse not to accept what we have to say about words like adoption, priothesia, things like that, the limiting of the covenants to the physical children of Israel, people just won't accept that. They just don't get it.
Well, I think the minute you start making sense, Bill, is the minute that they want to start shutting you down because they don't want to hear it.
Yeah.
You start making sense and they're like, oh my, this guy's making too much sense. I don't want to hear anymore. Shut it down.
Well, this guy today was focused on that word adoption and insisted that his definition of adoption was the correct definition, which it's not. And even with that, Romans chapter 9, Paul says that the adoption is for Israel, his kinsmen according to the flesh. He says that very clearly. So the adoption is for Israel. Paul's the only one that uses the word adoption. Paul knows more than anybody how he uses the word adoption, because he's the only one that uses it in the whole New Testament. So he says it's for Israelites, his kinsmen according to the flesh. And this guy just refused to acknowledge that.
Yep.
They always quote the line about adoption from Galatians. They never quote it from Romans chapter 9. They always quoted Galatians. So the way it's worded in Galatians, it seems like it might be universal, but not in Romans chapter 9, and they refuse to acknowledge it. He refused it. And so I got really raw with him, let's put it that way, as I usually do when somebody is thick-headed. And
You're helping him though.
It melted you're giving him real quick.
You're giving him one last chance to grow a brain.
They just won't do it. That's a good way to put it, though. One last chance to grow a brain.
Yeah, well, you know, if he's not going to accept the truth, I mean, he's going to end it in a trial. So you're actually helping him the way I see it. If he's a white guy, if he's not a white guy, you know.
Yeah, I kind of called him on that, too.
There might be a lot less white guys in the world than what we think.
I'm afraid that's probably true. Melissa and I talk about that all the time. There aren't as many people white as we think there are. It's crazy.
You want me to cut it?
Yeah, we could end here. We could cease here. I think we've done enough. Wow, one more chapter of Amos. Sorry. I thought it was more than 9 chapters. But we're good here.